Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
That's the kind of thing I might typically say, well, you shouldn't feel that way. That's a wrong interpretation of the facts and what's going on here in our relationship. You just got to look at it from this perspective and you'll see that it's not what you think it is, and you don't have to feel that way.
It must be an active effort for me to pull myself away from that tendency to react in a, well, you should have, and, you know, please, other person, conform to my feelings about this particular issue. And
we all do that. I mean, my granddaughter Lucy was living with us for over a year, and she's talking about one of her friends one time, and she said, you know, she shouldn't feel that way. I was like, time out. you can't go there. And it's not just between Sarah and I. I think it's universal. You just can't go there. And it's a normal knee-jerk reaction because that feeling feels stupid to me.
Bill and I know each other going back to AA History Lovers Symposiums. And we'd often be presenting at the same symposium. And I remember while he was compiling his data from writing the big book, The Creation of AA, it was very, I mean, that'd be interesting, the story of, right, you know, sort of a director's cut, like places where he got stuck, where, you know, he couldn't, you know, there was a break in the sort of connection and things he was sort of struggling with. And also, as he describes many times, how the facts didn't line up with the age-old stories he'd been told so many times. So during COVID, the History Lovers Symposium didn't really sort of carry on. And we were honestly finding an excuse to spend some time together. And I have a publishing company, and he had a new book that I'm sure other publishing companies would have been happy to get involved with. But it was just a way for us to sort of work together. And I love this book for a number of reasons. It's all about his recovery, but he doesn't talk in sort of recovery ease that we're so familiar with. He includes everybody in the discussion because he's not relying on sort of cliches and insider language that is often used in recovery. And I think there's a great message there that we need to find a way to sort of, you know, be out loud about our recovery, but not fall into this sort of, you know, language trap that we get away with in meetings, because it excludes people. You know, we have acronyms and we have sayings that make sense to us and people laugh. And then a first timer would go, what? I don't get it. And so 30 Things talks in, you know, anybody who is a seeker and would be able to read this and go, yeah, I like this chapter. I'm wrestling with that chapter. And I totally get that chapter because, you know, it's like you were reading my mail type of thing. That's Bill. And this is his first work, sort of puts the spotlight on him, the most sort of vulnerable and self-revealing sort of writing he's done, which was a home run in the way he did it.
You know, it reminded me a little bit of your Daily Reflections book, Joe, or in the format, you know what I mean? And in the, great minds think alike, I suppose. How's it going, Bill?
It's going well. Thanks for the invitation to show up here today and talk a little bit about my book with four such interesting men. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I wrote a book on the German philosopher Nietzsche, University of Chicago Press, 95, translated into German in 02. I wrote Writing the Big Book, did 11 years of research, last seven years of that writing. And we're coming up on the fifth anniversary and 20,000 copies of that book. So I'm very, very happy with that. I also did a step work group guide that's been published. It was circulating in PDF format for over a decade, and now it's out on, you can get it on Amazon. And then, as Joe said, I went into this real personal zone with this 30 Things book. Those other three didn't touch on that. And I complained to him bitterly a couple of times about my worry about the reactions I would get to me being so naked, about being a complete asshole and needing some direction to move myself out of that particular zone into something that's a little bit more fruitful. I mean, the subtitle of the book is Practical Advice for Living Well. Living well. You know, it's that kind of Aristotle talks about flourishing. What we want to do in life as individual human beings is to flourish. And I think living well is the end goal of the flourishing, although it's an ongoing process and doesn't happen just like that. That's not the way it works. It's funny, as the book has come out, I've gotten different kinds of reactions to people, and in some cases, no reactions. My lady Sarah and I have been out to dinner with what we think of as, you know, non-AA people, as civilians, you know, and we're so used to talking very, very intimately that many times when we've been in those situations, we see this shocked reaction on the other couple's face, and we think, oh my God, we just crossed the line here, you know, because real people don't talk about those kind of things that openly. And I think I'm getting a little bit of pushback on the book from those kind of people. And it's not so much pushback. They haven't written me back. I've sent them a copy of the book and they haven't written me back and said, damn, I really like that book. That was a good book. Thank you very much for that. One way or the other, I haven't heard back from a whole bunch of people that, and I said to Joe, I can't figure out what's going on here. I think that's what's going on, because it is in fact a very, very personal book. And now that it's out and I get three steps back from it, I noticed a couple of things. One of the most important things wasn't something I noticed, but that Joe's lady Mary noticed. She read the book, and they were up visiting us at one point a month or so ago. And Mary said, "You know what I think this book really is?" I said, "No, what is it, Mary?" She said, "It's a love story. It's a love story between you and your wife, because it just comes up over and over and over and over again. How you navigated, you had to relearn how to navigate through this relationship. I had to learn how to communicate. I had to learn what the right timing was for communication. I had to learn how to say things so that my wife heard what I wanted her to say, as opposed to, you know, the things that she thought I was saying. You know, it was clear communication. I mean, the number three chapter in this book is, whatever you think the problem is, it's a communication problem. And that's kind of how that went. So again, three steps back, there's this, certainly this large element of it being a love story. I mean, Sarah doesn't figure in all 30 of those chapters, but she's in a lot of them. The other thing that I think really comes out, I'm thinking about what's the thread that runs through this book. And I think the thread that runs through this book is we need to get our heads out of our butt and start paying attention to the world around us, most especially the other people in our lives. You know, it's not, you know, a book famously says selfishness is self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our problem. Oh yeah, we could have made that one of the things, except I was really avoiding AA lingo when I wrote this book. There's no identification whatsoever with me as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or a sober person or any of that stuff. I pointedly avoided that. But the fact of the matter is it seems to come back always, where the problem, when I identify the problem in my life, it's that it's all about me. It's all about me, you know? And why wouldn't it be all about me? Good God, I'm the most interesting person in the room here. So of course it's all about me. And I had to really learn, I had to identify first that was my problem. That was my problem. You know, if Sarah wasn't hearing what I was saying to her in the conversation, the way I wanted her, the things I wanted her to hear, obviously I was the problem. She wasn't the problem. I had to be communicating better. And I don't know, you know, like the second chapter doesn't have anything to do with personal relationships. It's called, my friend Steve, early on in his career, was meeting with a business mentor, and the business mentor said to him on one of these monthly lunches, he said, Steve, do you want to know the secret of success in American business? And Steve was like, yeah, he pulled out a pencil and paper. And the guy said, no, it's simple. Find out what your boss wants, then do it. You mean my opinion on what an idiot my boss is and that this is the wrong thing for us to be doing? If you really want to get to that goal over there, is the wrong approach? Yes, that's the wrong approach. Mm-hmm. The right approach is to take that self-centeredness, that selfishness, that monofocus that I was certainly born with or developed very, very quickly, and realize that it needs to be ameliorated.
When did that process begin in earnest? The really living well and the really looking at your relationships and getting out of that mono mind that you're talking about, because you're sober, right? And so physical sobriety was just the opening spark of like a much longer process.
Yes, Patrick. I mean, it's of the 30 things, they all occurred to me in sobriety. None of them happened to me during my drinking days. I wasn't tempted once with one thing that I remembered from my drinking days. I was 38 years old when I got sober on December 7th, 1981. And I've been active and sober and Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. You know, I turned 81 recently, so I'm closing. I got 42 years of sobriety. And a lot of this stuff, but not all of this stuff, came from AA people or from Alcoholics Anonymous in general. I did a little word count, not a word count, but a little chapter summary the other day, and I looked at them, and 12 of the 38 came from Alcoholics Anonymous, friends within Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 of the 30 things. But one of them was that thing my friend Steve, who's an AA, gave me about, you know, find out what your boss wants and do it. So it's not an AA thing. It's not a sobriety thing. It's like, if you want to have a successful business career, this is an important thing for you to be paying attention to. And sometimes that means, you know, you just got to shut up and sit back and do what you're told. Or if that's not working for you, find another job.
Your aim was to talk about emotional sobriety in relationships.
First of all, welcome, Bill. It's great to
have
you.
Thank you, Alan. Nice to be here. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you as well. And I'm glad to hear about your success with your book in terms of writing a big book. It really needed to be done. I mean, we really need to have a clear understanding of our history and the development unfolding. I was going to ask you a question about that. In your research, was there any mention of emotional sobriety back then from Bill?
Not that I saw ever. No, it wasn't until that famous letter that whole thing surfaced as
that propelled it. But in the 12 and 12, he used the phrase when he's describing step 12. So it's somewhere, what was the 12 and 12 written in 50, I think, right around that time?
Early 50s.
Yeah, early 50s, like 54, I think.
Letter was penned in 1953. So okay. It was published, I think that the 12 and 12 was published around 52 or 53. But the interesting thing is it was obviously a part of his consciousness. That's where it came from in terms of the letter. And he'd been doing a lot of work on it. In fact, in the 12 and 12, he says at the end of the first paragraph, when he's talking about step 12, he says, if we practice the principles, these 12 principles in our daily life, that we and those about us begin to find emotional sobriety. So he expressly stated that after physical sobriety, the goal is emotional sobriety. I can't tell you, Bill, I did a men's retreat the other day, a couple weekends ago, and there was about 30 guys that have a lot of time. I asked them, have you guys ever heard anybody say that in a meeting? Not one of them heard it. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. It's expressly stated, and yet nobody is grasping this idea that once we get the plug in the jug, it's all about learning to live our life and bringing, and this is the key thing, and that you captured it. Bill talks about steps, you know, 6 and 7 as developing the best possible attitude towards life and towards our relationships with ourselves and others. And that's what you're capturing there. You're saying, hey, how can I cultivate the best possible attitude and presence in my life that allows me to influence to whatever degree I can having healthy relationships with those people I love and care about?
Yeah.
And that's what you're doing, man. And that's what I love about the book, is because you're taking us on your journey with you. That's how I see it. It's like this journey through a consciousness that is starting out what I would call pretty undifferentiated, immature, whatever label you want to put on it. And we see the evolution of your growth and development. And you're moving, even though you don't say it, but you're moving towards emotional sobriety. The whole journey, everything you're talking about is you're becoming more and more. First of all, the first thing that stands out in your book, you go from not taking responsibility to taking radical responsibility for your existence. And yes, that's powerful, man. You described that very well. And that's the path of, you know, the arc of emotional sobriety, the arc of our program. You know, I believe the 12 steps help us learn to take responsibility for our existence and bring the best possible attitude to whatever issue we're confronting.
Alan, I like the word arc because to me, it means that, you know, that it's not like going to the supermarket and getting a loaf of bread and bringing it home and you got it. You know, it's something, it's an ongoing progressive thing. It happens in, I like the word spectrum. I think everything in life, everything in the world, everything in the universe exists on a spectrum in one way or another. So, I mean, one of the things that happens in this book, I talk about getting caught out, being immature to use, you know, caught out. And then I have to, somebody offers me a solution to that immaturity that's going to make my life, I'm going to be able to live a little bit better. And then I try to move into that space. And sometimes moving into that space is, okay, I can move into that space. And other times it's like, you got to be kidding me. I got to move into that space. I don't want to move into that space. But but there it is. It really is. I started a meditation meeting locally here, an AA meditation meeting in 08. And we read, you know, out of the big book 1 week, and then the next week we did the reading out of the 12 and 12. So that emotional sobriety thing turned up every other week for years. And sometimes that was what we focused on. But you know, you're absolutely right. It's the necessary element to living well once you stop drinking booze or taking whatever it is you took that got you in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yeah. So I applaud the work you've been doing for so long and so effectively in this particular arena, because we need to pay as much attention to it as any. You can put any label on it you want. I mean, this emotional sobriety is certainly as good as anything else, and it's part of the literature, so that's good. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah. No, I resonate with the journey you've been on, and you know, I think each one of us in this room could tell a story that follows a similar pattern in terms of waking up. See, that's the other thing I saw in your book. You went from being asleep to waking up. Yeah. I mean, you really did. You were asleep in so many areas. And I love that line by Gurdjieff. He says, you know, we are a people that are in a trance, and that we are dreaming, we're awake when we're really asleep. I mean, yeah. And that's so true. We think we got this thing, man. And then all of a sudden you get this feedback. But look, the other thing that happened in this, it wasn't that you were just always open to the feedback, because that's not how change takes place. Sometimes we got to feel the resistance to it, and we got to try to understand, what is it that, you know, I'm being given this, I don't like it. I don't like what's being said to me. What is going on? And that examination, you know, Bill calls it self-searching. That ability to start having that curiosity about what is going on here. How come I've got such a strong reaction to this? What's happening? See, that is one of the gifts of recovery, isn't it? Yeah. That ability to look at ourselves and bring an interest and a curiosity that we didn't have before.
Well, that's where the term undifferentiated really comes in handy for me, is because when I differentiate myself from the people, places, and things that are giving me that negative stimulation, I have some room to move, and, you know, there's some things that I can do to address that. When it's all mixed up, I get confused pretty easily.
Yeah. And it also happens intrapsychically, as Tom and I will talk about a lot, is that when we are fused with the different parts in ourselves, that we lose the ability, right, to, quote, manage, and, you know, we'll use that term loosely, to be able to manage our lives well. Is when you're blended to these self parts and you identify with them, you lose sight of who you really are. And that causes all kinds of problems. So that's just, we'll do a whole show on that maybe next week.
So Patrick wants us to read chapter 9, Embrace the Fact That We're All Different.
Do you think we can all agree on that?
I think so. We got a fighting chance.
I don't know. I feel different about it.
So we're going to have to embrace that, I guess, Alan.
From 30 Things, 9, embrace the fact that we are all different. This piece of advice gradually grew out of my own experience, and I've struggled mightily over the years to wrap my head and my everyday perspective around it. It's been a long, slow process of realization and an even longer battle to internalize it. For decades, my simple solution to the mystery of other people's minds was to presume they all thought exactly the same way I did. And if they didn't, well, they certainly should. As simple as that. I was blindly unaware of this, it's all about what I think perspective, at least in those stark and naked terms. But it was certainly how I operated. I believed it.
The result was that on more than one occasion, I found myself loudly declaring, well, that's all wrong. Let me tell you how you should be thinking about this. My unconscious belief about the sameness of our thoughts was the result of a number of different influences, several from my upbringing, but I believe that many more can be traced back to a number of foundational elements in our Western culture. Take, for instance, the classic philosophical proof, all men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Or the famous American political statement, all men are created equal. There are enough examples of this kind of thing to easily fill this page. Unconsciously internalizing these familiar quotations, along with so many other similar cultural signals, I had blindly fallen into a trap of believing that all men are the same. Nothing could be further from the truth.
My painfully slow awakening to the reality of these fundamental differences between people began in earnest during the early days of my relationship with the Lady Sarah. The more intimate we became, and the more I learned about how she thought, the more impossible it became to ignore how different that was from the way I thought. In fact, it was nothing like the way I thought. All too frequently, we seem to be talking about different things, or at least coming at them from such completely different perspectives that they might as well have been different things.
Over time, the first blush of this insight grow until it had to admit that it was just not Sarah who was substantially different from me. Everyone, regardless of their age, sex, wealth, class, upbringing, or cultural conditioning, experienced the world and processed those experiences in ways that were far different from mine. I have, for instance, several friends that I frequently have trouble, quote-unquote, following when we talk. It seems as if they are almost, quote, playing with a different deck of cards, end quote. Whatever premises and foundational materials they are working with are so different from my own thought patterns that I frequently have a hard time just, quote unquote, getting them, no matter how diligently I might try to understand exactly what it is they are trying to tell me. That doesn't mean the situation is hopeless, but until I recognized, acknowledged, and accommodated the fundamental differences in other people's experiences, their processing and thinking, the problem was insurmountable. Once I realized the necessity of accommodating other people's mindsets and committed to being attentive rather than just presumptive and judgmental, real conversations with real communication all of a sudden started to become possible.
I have to give just one more example, a good friend who is very religious. My own worldview, on the other hand, includes no supernatural elements whatsoever. This doesn't mean that my friend is wrong. He just experiences and processes the world differently from me. We may both be contemporary American males with many common foundational experiences, but we have also been exposed to and live completely different spiritual lives. And those experiences have resulted in two very different ways of being in the world. Still, once we both acknowledged that fact, and then respectfully honored our differences, we found that we can have truly meaningful, even deeply spiritual conversations about our respective and sometimes complementary opinions of the things that matter most to us in life.
Who would have thought such a thing possible? We are all different. It is a basic fact of life. Becoming fully aware of that fact and then acting on it has opened up new perspectives in all my relationships and thereby enriched my life immeasurably. Think of it as the most extreme form of democratic pluralism imaginable.
Amen.
What a lovely continuation from last week, you know, where we were talking about contentious conversations and accommodating other people's perspectives, allowing the perspectives, and what Alan's always talking about, adding more self, you know, like advocating for yourself without erasing the other person, and vice versa.
Bill, this is the reason we have Patrick here, because he remembers what we did last week, because the rest of us are very unlikely to remember. So we appreciate his young memory.
Well, but it's hard. I guess I just wanted to maybe like push off with this, that to sit with somebody that you disagree with, and the hotter the issue, the hotter the whatever, the more difficult that becomes to just be with a person and to not feel that jumping sense from inside yourself to kind of crush this thing, this aspect of the other person that you do not, that does not sit well with you.
And the matter, also on how much the subject matter you care about. You know, somebody wants to be, there are a lot of things you can disagree with, and I can disagree with you, and I listen to you all day long. Doesn't bother me a bit, you know, but if you start talking about something, you know, that I'm going, I have a very strong opinion about that, then that's that. I've got to hold that guy back so this, we make room for some other people to get to the front so they can listen. Because like what Bill says in there, it's like, because until we understand, however, whatever metaphor system you use, but we understand that we have that is our responsibility to listen to other people who are completely different from us. That's a skill set all its own. Because, you know, we talk about empathy. We often think about that just as emotional empathy. But empathy is about, there's also mental empathy. I need to kind of understand how this person thinks. As I listen to them, I learn that. And you put yourself in that place. And sure enough, if you do, what they're saying, even if you disagree with it, will make sense. Yeah. And things, somebody can make sense and you could still disagree with them, by the way.
Well, you know, let's kind of look at Bill's chapter from this lens of what we're talking about with emotional sobriety, right? Is going from a consciousness that says I'm okay if, to a consciousness that says I'm okay even if. And let's just look at how that happens. So, you know, we've talked a lot about differentiation, and we all start out very undifferentiated. And you know, this may be a different word for you, Bill, but all those things that you described, the kind of consciousness you have, is a consciousness that develops very early in life as a child, right? It's all about me. And this culture reinforces it, and that's okay. Egocentrism, it has to happen, right? That's the only way a self has a chance of developing. But if we're met in the right way, then as we develop, you start to differentiate yourself from other people. But you have to come from a family that had a higher degree of differentiation. And none of us have that. You just don't get it. So what happens is we leave our family with this undifferentiated consciousness that says, if you love me, you'll think the way I think. If you love me, you'll do what I want you to do. See, that undifferentiated consciousness has all of these rules that anything that's different than sameness is a threat. And so all this energy goes into trying to manipulate the person and convince them that they should think the way we do. Because obviously, we're the enlightened ones. Or we think we are. Right? Kind of thing, you know, follow me to the top of the mountain. Well, usually sometimes, you know, my partner said, no, it feels like following you to hell is what's really going on. Yeah, we're not going to any damn mountain. You're taking me to hell with your ideas about what the hell is going on. So it's a wonderful, see, from that perspective, you see the emotional maturity or the emotional sobriety starting to happen. With Bill, he starts to differentiate himself, starts to realize, oh, my God, people can think differently, and that's not a threat to my relationship. It actually increases intimacy. You see, true intimacy is the eye-to-thou experience. We have to be able to see the other person. You can't see the other person when you make everything about you because there's no empathy. See, that's the thing that dies with a lack of differentiation. Empathy is impossible. You can't feel safe. Love cannot grow in a relationship where there's no empathy. Not going to happen. You got to feel safe. The only way you feel safe is if somebody sees you and it doesn't necessarily give what you want privilege, but respects what they see in you. And that's what Bill was saying. You know, Kempler had a great line, my mentor, Bill. He was one of the pioneers in family and couples therapy. And he said, a healthy family is when couple sees differences as desirable. Differences as desirable. My God, it's taken a long time for us, those of us that are on this journey, to be able to get to the point of really being able to see that and to see them as desirable and valuable to a relationship and not a threat. See, that's the old way of thinking. That's one of those old ideas that we got to let go of. This is the new idea, is that differences are desirable to be respected. And by doing that, we create more intimacy, not less.
Alan, you talk about intimacy, and it's funny, when Tom was talking, I realized that I still haven't gotten there. You know, I mean, with my friend Billy, who I've sponsored for over 30 years and who's a born-again Christian, we have an intimacy and I can do that with him. I can cut him all kinds of slack. Somebody comes knocking on my door for a political candidate I don't care about at all, I'm not going to cut him the same kind of slack. I come out and flood my friend Billy. And I have a great story on this, how far we can go with this. I was trying to get Billy to meditate. He would come over here every couple of weeks and a couple of months. And we were talking. I was trying to get him to meditate on a regular basis, something I had adopted late in my sobriety. I was 26 years sober before I started doing that. Mm-hmm. And he just wasn't getting there, you know. So now he's a big Christian. So before I came over one time, I counted the number of chapters in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There's 89 chapters. I was like, oh, this is cool. So now I read something every morning before I meditate. And I said to Billy, I said, listen, I want you to meditate, but how about, this is an entry point, why don't you read one chapter of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and it'll get you through 3 months, you know, and then meditate afterwards and get you through 3 months. That'll be your touchstone for 3 months. And he said, okay, I can do that. Now that was a Saturday, and he started reading on Sunday morning. Monday morning, I thought to myself, I haven't read the New Testament all the way through in decades. So I read two chapters so that we were doing the same thing. And for 3 months, we read the New Testament. You know, bang, bang, bang. We were not reading the same book. We were not reading the same book at all. But we would get together and talk about, he would tell me what he got out of that particular set of chapters. And I would tell him what I got out of the particular set of chapters. And because of our intimacy, we could cut each other enough slack that not only could I sit there and listen to him say stuff that, you know, that I don't believe in, but you know, just to get to know him better and how he operates and how he works. So, you know, that's...
You're not making anybody wrong there. This fits, I promise. One of the things I have clients do after sessions sometimes is send me little bullet points, what their takeaways from the session are. I've never gotten those bullet points and they had anything to do with what I took away. It's like, so that, and that just, that didn't, at first I thought that I was missing the point, but no, what they told me is that this person and me, we pay attention to different stuff because I remembered everything that she says. I'm thinking of one most recently, and go back to what you're saying, Bill, that became the fuel behind the next session, the conversations, because it's all based on our differences. But it wasn't about arguing. It was about saying, I noticed this, you noticed that. So, yeah.
I know, you know, Earl Hightower has this great story. He tells about having a newcomer and he hears a Charlie or somebody speaking across town and he thinks, oh, this is the guy that this newcomer needs to hear. Charlie's gonna nail it and draw it out of the ballpark. And they drive across town, they go to the meeting, after the meeting, and he's in the meeting, he's like, oh, Charlie's nailing it, he's nailing it, this is fabulous. And he said, they get in the car and he says to the guy, so how'd you like the meeting? And the guy starts telling him about the meeting. And Earl says, it's clear to me we weren't at the same meeting at all.
Another thing we talk about, Bill, is that in a healthy relationship, there's room for two people. There's got to be room enough for two. And before, see, the undifferentiated consciousness says there's only room for my rules. It doesn't make room for people. It's trying to make room for rules. And you can't have an intimate relationship based on all these rules, right? Because love has to be, like you said, it's a result of who we are with each other, right? We can't command it. We can't direct it. We can't, you know, program it. It's got to be a result, a byproduct of what kind of relationship we have. And so it's great, man. Once again, you see the development of emotional sobriety, even though you didn't mention that. It's cool.
Vive la différence is the whole spirit, you know, the sort of Euro way of saying this. In AA parlance, it's unity is the most important thing for our survival, not uniformity. Mm-hmm. Unity. But treating everybody as equals, even though we're different. And one of the things I was thinking about this week was, well, what's the difference? Isn't emotional sobriety just emotional intelligence? There was already a word for that, but it's not. We all have our emotional intelligence, but are we in a sober state or an inebriated state? And Tom was talking about, I can give people all the room in the world until they discuss something that, you know, I'm highly emotional about, mm-hmm. and that becomes more difficult. And the experience would be, I was involved in a group in Toronto that was an agnostic atheist group, and people didn't mind that, you know, we were a discussion group and they were a book-based group. They didn't mind that we met at 5 o'clock and they met at 7 o'clock, but they sure mind that we wrote a set of steps that was secular, that didn't refer to a supernatural deity. It referred to a higher power as mm-hmm. something, you know, earthly, like the fellowship or like the program, you know, to be determined by the individual. And that, you know, that was, you know, that we couldn't do that because now we were hitting at something that was very emotionally charged for them. It was an existential threat for them. And that group was, you know, the idea was to kick it out of AA. We'll delist it from the inner group. We'll starve it to death because newcomers won't find it. But the law of unintended consequences has its way in AA because that's an old story. That's an essay Bill wrote in 1946 about every group and their set of rules. They go on these rule-making binges and the Pharisees and the recalcitrants and, you know, just everyone's hair on fire. I mean, we repeat that over and over, even with the traditions, because their traditions, there's no AA police. There's no way to enforce them. They're what we've learned from our mistakes. They're not the rules that your membership is dependent on, because you can ignore all of them and there's no one there to take your toys away. You're still an AA group. And that's what we're talking about, making room for another and another and another and another. There's a funny story about the second meeting in LA. Well, they got a letter from the first meeting ever in LA from their lawyer saying, no, we have the AA franchise in Los Angeles. You must cease and desist. You can't run a meeting. We're AA, right? And of course, how many meetings are there in Los Angeles now, right? You know, who is right and who is wrong, right? But that's that sort of intolerance that comes from being emotionally inebriated, not emotionally sober, right? Where our emotions get the best of us and we can't make room for somebody else. So it was just boom, 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 how these things came together today.
Here's an example of how we take different things from the conversation. I'll bet nobody else besides me took this from this conversation, from listening to Joe. Let's all go to an AA conference sometime in the near future and do a skit about being the AA police. We can dress like the Keystone Cops. It'll be perfect.
I could have taken that from what he was saying, but you just beat me to the punch.
Oh, yeah, you could have, but you didn't.
I didn't take that at all, Tom.
Thank you, Alan.
I had no idea that at all.
That's not where I would have gone. Yeah.
What I was thinking about is when I went over to Vietnam in 2011, 40 years after I was I left the country after serving combat over there, I was invited to be a part of a small group, four-man group. We were ambassadors from the United States called the Gift of Recovery. And we started in North Vietnam and we traveled all the way to South Vietnam to share with them of how recovery could be possible without medication. Because at that point, and it's all medication-assisted treatment over there. It's all methadone. They have over 60 methadone clinics in Vietnam. At least that was the goal that they were striving for, and they probably achieved it by now. So we were there to talk about the possibility of helping people without medication, right? That they could find some path in their life that would be completely drug-free, right? Well, it's a communist country. I had to submit every one of my talks and all of my PowerPoints for censorship. And I wanted to talk about the therapeutic value of the 12 steps. So the first shot was, right, just to put the steps as they were. They came back and said, I'm sorry, you can't mention God. There's only one ultimate authority in our country, and that's the Communist Party. So I said, okay, how about higher power? I went back, I changed everything. Oh, no, there's only one higher power, the Communist Party. That wouldn't even fly. You know what finally allowed me to higher self?
Yeah.
They would let me present with higher self. So we live, and I'm very grateful for this. And like I said, I'd defend this country tomorrow. In fact, after 2000, after what happened in 9/11, right? I went to the recruiting office. I was like 51 years old or 50 years old. And I went to volunteer to go back in the Marine Corps, right? To go serve, to go over there and paying them back for the terrorist attack in New York. The recruiting sergeant looks at me and says, Dr. Berger, I appreciate your spirit and your enthusiasm, but I think it would be best to leave the fighting for the younger guys. Well, he didn't respect that difference, Joe. What happened? It wouldn't let me back in. No, but we do live in a culture that allows that freedom of speech, and we take it for granted, folks. You know, we can appreciate differences here. That's not true all over the world.
Well, I mean, one of the talks at ICSA was AA in a Polarized World by a professor from University of Florida. And that's it. Like to be able to make room for people who completely politically or spiritually or method of recovery-ish, right? To make room for them, even though you completely oppose their value system, but to grant them that sort of, equalness, the right to say what they say without, trying to persuade or dissuade them from their ridiculous position.
I have the fear sometimes when I'm engaging in these conversations that to cede certain territory or to be with somebody in their difference would render my belief meaningless, or that it would somehow neutralize, my conception of the world. And that's not necessarily the case, but I think that is there's a thread of fear going through it.
Sure. Same thing on the other side, Patrick. See, that's what's fueling some of the struggles we're seeing politically right now, is that our culture is so undifferentiated. There's no room, as Bill was saying, for differences. Differences are seen as a threat, and we've got to destroy the other side and make them wrong so that we're right, and we want to control the narrative. And so there isn't that tolerance because we are not a culture based on wisdom. See, one way of looking at AA, it's a subculture. We're really developing a a culture based on wisdom in Alcoholics Anonymous, not based on the capitalism and materialism that occurs in our society. And it's very different, man. We're counterculture. We're counterculture here. You know, we're talking about things that don't fit in. And Bill recognizes this, you know. He says, we lost sight of that character is what counts. We really did. We get too focused on having and not on being. Now, I'm all for balance, right? Bill talks about a balance. I love this culture. I love capitalism. I love having things. But I also want to balance it with being, right? We want to try to find. That's what emotional sobriety is about, finding that balance. Well, this was great, man. I'm glad, Bill. Let's do it again, man. It was fun.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Listen, Alan, you talked about censorship. My favorite story about this particular chapter may not even fit into this podcast, but Patrick can take it out if he wants. So that's okay. So I was writing this chapter, and I started talking about the differences between men and women. And my lady, Sarah, who proofs everything I read, she said, you can't do that. No, you're going to get crucified if you do that. I said, honey, it says right here, I'm all for economic and legal. You know, you got to be absolutely equal in those spheres, but you got to recognize the fact that we're different. Now, this is a conversation I have with guys I sponsor all the time. They're over here and their mother's the problem, their wife's the problem, their sister's the problem. It's always some woman who's the problem. And what I've tried to do with people to point out the differences that we all need to accept in each other is I say, now, listen, you got to realize that women are different from men. And they say, what are you talking about? I said, no, here's the deal. Women are like Macintoshes. They're intuitively based. Men are like PCs. They are logical, straight line. This is how it works thing kind of thing. Now, they can both send emails. They can both write Word documents. They can both go on the internet, but they got different operating systems. And if you don't recognize that your wife, mother, girlfriend, or whatever has a different operating system, because you come in here bitching that you can't understand how she could possibly say these things or think these things or feel these things. Well, get over it, pal. She's got a different operating system and you need to figure out what's going on with her and acknowledge it and accept it.
One of my favorite books that Robert Bly wrote was called The Sibling Society. He was a great American poet. And he said, the big mistake we're trying to do is to make a homogenous society and saying we're all the same. Big problem when we don't respect these differences. We're not all the same.
Yeah, we are always and ever all the same. Schneider, my therapist, Larry Schneider, my wife and I, he's mentioned as Larry in the book a number of times, but we always called him the Schneid. Then the Schneid used to say, one of the great fallacies of American culture, Western culture, is that when you fall in love, you don't have any problems or disagreements. It's one of those foundational things people don't really talk about, but it's right there in almost every relationship when they show up in my office. And the point is, we're always going to have differences. Always, always, always. And the point is to put your cards on the table face up and check out each other's cards and then do some negotiation.
I'm keeping that part in.
All right.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you're with.